again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again. All together shout it now. There's no one who can doubt it now. So let's tell the world about it now. Happy days, happy days are here again. Your cares and troubles are gone. There'll be no more from now on. Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. So let us sing a song of happy cheer again. Happy, happy, happy days are here again.
Mystic Pete here with a show called the Mystic Pete Chronicles. Thank you, Annabelle. Another great show. Serenata de Trios. You're on 6 to 7 every Sunday night, and I follow that with my talk show. We are at KXLU 88.9 FM in LA, KXLU.com, all around the world. And I have a charming co-host tonight, Christine. Hi, Christine.
It's a lovely, beautiful night to be here.
That's a nice radio voice.
Thank you so much.
I know you have ambitions of being more in radio, and I'm so glad that we can take this opportunity. We have a very special show that features LA Theater Works, latw.org. It's an interview with Susan Loewenberg. She's the producing director. So we're going to play that interview in a minute, but I just first wanted to have Christine meet you all and you meet her. You know, she was on last week, but this is the first of many. And, you know, this is a rising star in Los Angeles. So here we are. You guys are getting to meet her on the way up. Well, what else would you like to tell Los Angeles before we play the interview with LA Theater Works?
I'm just so grateful to be here.
Well, you were saying this campus was beautiful. How the sun was setting as you were walking up.
Oh my God, it was so gorgeous. Parking and looking around the campus. And the sky is so clear and beautiful. It's a lovely, beautiful day.
I don't know if people have been to the Loyola Marymount University campus, but it's very beautiful here.
Oh my God. Everybody will be so grateful. All the students must be so happy to be here, just watching the sky every day.
Well, it's run by the Jesuits, and a very actually open-minded faction of the Catholic Church. It seems like it's kind of just a little-known jewel of Los Angeles, but there's a church across from the radio station called the Sacred Heart Church. You saw it?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Beautiful, huh?
Oh, my God. I just love the name.
There we go.
Sacred Heart.
Sacred Heart. So we're going to be sending everybody out there some Sacred Hearts over the airways. Let me get to the interview. Now, this is Susan has been producing live radio-oriented theater pieces for years. And I guess they're up to about 600 plays that they've recorded and now are podcast and played over radio. And we're going to get to one of their signature productions later in the show called Babbitt. by Sinclair Lewis. I'd never read the book Babbitt, but I listened to all 14 hours of their production, and it was life-changing. It was absolutely beautiful. So we'll play a little of that. And the song I just finished after my theme song was called Happy Days Are Here Again, and that was from the era that Babbitt was written in. So we're doing a little bit of this old-fashioned music. So, Christine, are we ready to go with the interview?
Oh, my God, I'm excited.
All righty. Well, then, here we go with the interview of Susan Loewenberg, the producing director of L.A. Theater Works. Mystic Pete here with Susan Loewenberg, the producing director for L.A. Theater Works. Hi, Susan. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Let me allow you to introduce yourself and introduce LATW, latw.org for more information, and explain what's happening.
L.A. Theater Works is celebrating its 51st year in business. We have evolved over the years. One of the things I think that's been exciting for me and sort of kept me very much interested in my organization is how the organization has changed over the years. You know, when we started 51 years ago, we started as an organization called Artists in Prison. And what we were an organization that did workshops with inmates, first at the county jail, and then we segued into the state prison system and eventually into the federal system. We worked at Terminal Island, for example, for many, many, many years. And I think one of the things that has kept me so engaged with my organization is how many transitions, successful transitions, we've been able to achieve going from an arts in prison organization to an organization now that has accumulated recordings of over almost 600 plays, theater plays. We like to think the best of the classic group of plays and also some fabulous work by new and upcoming writers. We now have this unique library of almost 600 recordings. We have evolved from being an organization that did workshops in prisons to our present mission, which is, of course, is to record the best of American and international theater. And we have the largest library of its kind in the world. And we are thrilled to be able to, we have a weekly radio show on the on public radio stations throughout the United States. We have a streaming service, which is fairly new, where we're able to stream any piece, and you can go on latw.org and stream any play in our library of almost 600 plays. We're heard all over the world. I just got a lovely note from a gentleman in Pakistan who told me how much he was enjoying listening to LA Theater Works. And we're able to, we have a huge program with schools. We have over 2,000 teachers that we work with all over the United States, and we send them free recordings, which are appropriate for the junior and high school curricula. You know, I think one of the things that's exciting is figuring out all of the different ways that we can enable people to access great theater, no matter where they are. They can be in the middle of nowhere and get access to a terrific play at LA Theater Works. And the other thing, of course, that's been very rewarding is working with its fabulous theater artists, the actors, the directors, the sound designers. And we have probably worked with over 2,500 actors in the course of this journey. And that's been so rewarding and exciting. And it's everybody from an up and coming young actor to, you know, household names, the Richard Dreyfusses, Marsha Mason, Ed Asner, Hector Elizondo, the classic names, and then the fabulous up and coming artists that we are able to work with. So So it's a lot of fun. I hope that we are delivering a needed service to people. You know, if you don't have access to live theater, this is the next best thing.
Well, you're also working with some very notable arts organizations. Care to mention a few of those?
Yeah, I mean, we work with theaters all over the country because our fellow regional theaters get, for example, during the pandemic, we were able to send, you know, people needed something to keep their patrons engaged. And we did a project where we just gave free recordings to all of the theaters that wanted them all over the country. And that was a rewarding experience for us. And I hope it was helpful to theaters to keep their people engaged. One of the things that I'm proud of is that we've been able to supply people with rich cultural experiences because of what we do and the way in which we do it. We're broadcast all over the United States, but you can hear our broadcasts. If you go online, you can just hear the weekly broadcast and anywhere in the world. We're very honored to be able to provide cultural enrichment in the way that we do. As we say, anywhere, any place, any time.
Well, let's zoom out a second and consider where this belongs in our cultural timeline right now. I think a lot of particularly young people are getting media or their arts from social media. And they're used to a certain presentation, maybe a 15 or 30 second blip in their life. And it has to be quick and fast and punchy, maybe very sexual or disturbing. You know, for a lot of people, that's theater these days. And perhaps when younger people think of theater, they think of it some antique, some kind of older style thing that their parents went to. What are you finding with school children? Are they open to, you know, a longer format play? That play may go on for an hour or two or longer. How are they? Are they receptive? Do they have the capacity to concentrate? What's happening with this transmission to the next generation?
I think that fortunately, because we have this relationship with over 2,000 teachers, our teachers have been a wonderful bridge, and they have been able to introduce kids to what we do. And I think, for example, one of our biggest single seller is Arthur Miller's The Crucible. Now, The Crucible, you know, it's a tough read for kids. It's a very tough read. And what happened was somehow the kids discovered that The Crucible was available as an audio recording. I cannot tell you, it is our biggest single seller. I cannot tell you how many thousands of kids have accessed The Crucible through LA Theater Works. And it's so much for young people. I think being able to access that recording, then they can go back and read it. But the introduction through the live recording has been, I mean, I cannot tell you how many letters we've gotten from students, from teachers, you know, you know, you changed my life, basically, because there's something about being able, with certain kinds of material, to be able to listen is a very good way to introduce a young person to important literature. It's more, I think, engaging than just reading a Shakespeare play or a Tennessee Williams play. Because theater is meant, of course, as we know, theater is meant to be experienced as a live event. And this is a way, if you can't actually attend a live theater performance, this is a very, very good way, a very engaging way to experience theater, is by listening to an audio recording.
Yeah, I think when it's being presented by capable actors, it really makes it compelling and it draws you in. I'm just finishing The Seagull by LA Theater Works. You have Calista Flockhart. I mean, it's a powerful piece to begin with, but then you have these engaging actors that really draw you in. So, yes.
Yes. And you know, being in Hollywood, being where we are, we've had access to some of the world's most important and well-known actors. And that's been, of course, a terrific, terrific way for us to engage with the public, because we've got, you know, we have some of the most famous actors in the world doing our recordings. And for them, it's also terrific. They can go into a studio and in 3, 4, 5 days, do an impressive recording. And so people are very willing to do that.
Well, since Lucy has signed me up to interview you, I've listened to the following LA Theater Works productions: Frankenstein, Dracula, Babbitt, Oedipus the King, The Jungle, The Idiot, Brothers Karamazov, and The Seagull, catching up on some of my Russian literature. But I will say, listening to Babbitt all, what, about 12 hours?
14 hours.
Listening to all 14 hours of Babbitt, which I'd never read, and I'd never read Sinclair Lewis, it was, frankly, a life-changing experience. I mean, with Ed Asner at the helm of that production, I mean, what a powerful performance. I didn't realize the beauty of the language that this writer... It was wonderful. It was elevating.
Well, I have to tell you that Babbitt was actually our first project. Babbitt launched the new phase of LA Theater Works. What happened was, I'll give you a little brief history. I got a phone call. LA Theater Works had been doing, you know, live theater, and, you know, it was just we were a typical small theater company. And I got a call one day from the wife of the great actor Rene Aubergenois. Her name is Judith Aubergenois. And she said to me, you know, we've been watching LA Theater Works theater work in small theaters around town. And I have assembled a group of very famous actors. And she rattled off, you know, Richard Dreyfuss, Marcia Mason, Rene Aubergenois, Hector Elizondo, et cetera, et cetera. And we're very interested in perhaps doing something with you. And I thought, oh, well, okay, we'll explore that. That's interesting. Long story short, the actors came together, and the idea originally was that they were going to form a repertory company and do something like be another Mark Taper Forum. And that didn't happen. And one day, Richard Dreyfuss said, you know, I've always been interested in radio drama. And there's a station called KCRW, and a woman named Ruth Seymour runs the station. And why don't we go and talk to her? And I thought, oh, that's an interesting idea. Long story short, Ruth was very excited about it. And she proposed that we do a major project. And I had always loved Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt. I was a big fan of his. And so I suggested this piece, Babbitt. And of course, who was the perfect, perfect actor to play the lead? Ed Asner, right? As Babbitt. And at that time, the company consisted of 28 actors, and all of them participated. It took us a year. We recorded the book word for word. Every time a character came up, it was played by an actor. The same actor played the same character throughout. Plus, they split up the narration. Took us a year to do this at KCRW and another few months to edit it. And then Ruth aired it on Thanksgiving Day in 1980-something. And she aired it as a 14-hour special on Thanksgiving Day, and it exploded. It just was a sensation. And then NPR got in touch with us and said they wanted to air it. So they aired it in 3-hour segments every week. That was it. That put us on the map. And then we were asked by the Arthur Miller folks if we wanted to do the Crucible. And that, of course, became our first major, after Babbitt, our first major theater piece. And that was it. And 600 plays later, here we are.
By the way, René Auberjonois played Odo in the Star Trek series. Another big fan of his. So Babbitt was produced in studio, but a lot of your productions are recorded right from the stage.
Yes. So what happened was initially there's a hotel in Santa Monica. It was called the Guest Quarters Suite Hotel in Santa Monica. And we had gotten in touch with them. The fellow who was running the hotel at the time was very kind of an interesting guy. And he reached out to us and said, would you be interested in doing, you know, recordings in front of the audience? And I thought, well, that's an interesting idea. And they had a ballroom and they had a stage. And we started recording plays. We had no idea if anybody would be interested. So we sent out a big announcement, did a press release, and said we were going to record plays in front of the audience and people could come and watch. And every play was recorded four times, like Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I think two shows on Saturday and one on Sunday. And then we would edit to get the best result from each day of recording. Anyway, we announced it and people just responded like crazy. I mean, we had lines going out into the street, lining up at the Guest Quarters Suite Hotel to come and watch the recordings. And that launched it. And we were at Guest Quarters for many years. And then, of course, we transitioned to UCLA. We started it in LA, but then we expanded it. We went to Chicago. We recorded 80 plays in Chicago. We worked with the local radio station, the public radio station there. It was called Chicago Theaters on the Air. Then we went to Washington, D.C. This is all in the late 80s, early 90s. And then we went to Washington, D.C. We did Washington Theaters on the Air. We worked with the Voice of America and the Smithsonian Institution and recorded plays in the Voice of America Auditorium. Then we went up to Boston and did a whole series of plays in Boston. What happened was that we began to accumulate this library through all of these live recording adventures. And then we also continued to record plays in the studio. Up until the pandemic, we were at UCLA. We would record seven times a year, Friday night, Saturday two shows, Sunday afternoon, and then we would edit the shows together to make a great recording. Since the pandemic, of course, we have been had to have recorded, we record everything in studio, but we hope to go back to live performance with an audience in Los Angeles sometime in the next year.
So you're doing live performances, podcasts, you have the streaming service now available. People can find out more about that at latw.org. LA Theater Works. Well, is the LA related to Los Angeles? It sounds like you're an international organization.
Of course. Of course. There were times when people said, well, why do you call it LA Theater Works? You're a national organization. But, you know, this is our home. This is where we are.
Gotcha. And you're also doing high definition screenings from London, the London National Theater.
Yes. It started because we had an opportunity. We had a funder who was a very generous funder. We had done a terrific recording of The Importance of Being Earnest. And it was suggested to us that we perhaps they would, this funder said they would give us the money to actually make a film just like the National Theater live films of The Importance of Being Earnest. We did a recording on stage and we filmed it. And it's a terrific recording of The Importance of Being Earnest. And it's part of, we were in touch with the National Theater and they had begun this program called NT Live, where they would film their productions and then make them available all over the world to people who wanted to producers who wanted to expose audiences worldwide to their things. And we took it on. We decided we would become a distributor of the National Theatre Live films. And to this day, we are at UCLA. They have fabulous screening facilities. And we show the National Theatre Live films on a regular basis. People can just go on our website, latw.org, and they'll see the section that says NT Live, and they can buy tickets and come to the UCLA and see these wonderful screenings of the NT Live shows. But as I said, we did one ourselves, which was the importance of being earnest. I'd like to talk about a couple of new initiatives that we have. The one that I'm very, very excited about is called The Play Club. And our recordings are in most libraries, most of the public libraries throughout the country. There's, you know, several thousand libraries, of course, public libraries, and we're basically in virtually all of them. And as you know, libraries have book clubs. And so I got the idea that we should start a play club. And we would work with libraries all over the country and make this available to them. The idea being, once a month, we would give the library or any participating library a play, a recording, which they could distribute free to any of their patrons who were interested. Then people would come in to the library on a scheduled day, or they could participate on Zoom. We would provide a list of discussion topics based on the play, and a librarian, one of the local librarians, would host the gathering. People could also, if a local library didn't want to do that, they could just have their patrons watch our hosting on Zoom, because we would do a hosting of the play and a discussion group, and people could access it on Zoom if they liked. So that project is set to debut sometime probably in January or February, and we're calling it the Play Club, based on the idea of book clubs. So it's a similar notion. So that's very exciting. And then we've launched in partnership with a company called Exceptional. You can have access to our entire library of almost 600 plays.
Well, it's great to support art organizations, particularly in this very challenging time. But there's also resources where you can get these plays for free in Los Angeles. Los Angeles Public Library has Canopy, and you can download them.
Absolutely. And you can, then there's a whole group of plays. There's about almost 40 plays, if you go on our website, that are absolutely free. You know, we have one of our great partnerships is with the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. And the Sloan Foundation has been a generous supporter of LA Theatre Works for many years. And they're very interested in plays that with themes about science and technology. And we have recorded, I would say, there's about 28 to 30 plays that we have recorded that have science and technology themes. Those plays are on our website under the Sloan Foundation, and you can access those plays absolutely without charge. And many, many teachers, of course, take advantage of that. And they use the Sloan plays, which are terrific, terrific works that deal with issues around science and technology.
Well, I'm downloading them to my phone and listening in my car. And the thing is, I find them very addicting. Once you get into this, you just want to hear the next one and keep going from there. Well, this is Susan Loewenberg of LA Theatre Works, latw.org. You know, theater is not only about entertainment, but culture and the past and the present, but also mainly about thought and getting people to think and consider and ideas. More important than ever in these changing times, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there is so much wisdom in a play, in a good play. You know, there's a lot of wisdom. At the same time, of course, a good play ropes you in, you know, and the information in good plays is so skillfully and beautifully integrated into the storyline. And I think that's the magic of theater. That is the magic.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for your time. We'll do this again.
Okay. Thank you.
It was the most convenient dawn. I found $1 million baby in a 5 and 10 cent store. The rain continued for an hour. I hung around for 3 or 4. Around $1 million baby in a 5 and 10 cent store. She was selling china, and when she made those buying china until the crowd got wide. Incidentally, if you should run into a shower, just step inside my cottage door and meet the $1 million baby from the 5 and 10 cent
This is KXLU 88.9 FM in LA, KXLU.com all around the world. Mystic Pete here with a show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. Well, that was an interview I did with Susan Loewenberg of LATW, Los Angeles Theater Works, LATW.org. And in a minute, we're going to play from one of their signature productions, Babbitt by Sinclair Lewis. And it's from the era of the music I just played. So stay tuned for that. But my co-host is Christine. And Christine has some memories of being in the Philippines and listening to some of this music. Tell me about that.
Yay. It's just beautiful to be listening and reminding me of my childhood back in the Philippines. Listening to a very romantic song in a beautiful day afternoon in the farm, you know, with my grandparents, listening and, you know, appreciating life, you know, and the beauty of the sky and the birds singing around. It's just so peaceful and zen, just so grateful.
Was it kind of like a forest area or more like rice paddies or?
It's more like a rice field, but we have a lot of like a bamboo, you know.
Bamboo.
Like bamboo, yeah. So, and my relatives love to play music in the afternoon. So all the kids will be around playing and listening to it and, you know, having snacks together. So that's the quality of life that I'm missing.
It's much slower.
Yes, yes, yes. It's more slower and the quality, it's more simple.
It's simple, a simple life. Yes, it's, and you can appreciate the little things.
Yes, yes.
Nature,
yes,
the
yes.
insects, the butterflies.
Yes, yes, everything.
Delicious food that maybe your grandmother made or something like that.
Yes, yes.
Do you remember
yes.
what foods you ate? I know coconut's very big over there. Buko.
You know, actually, we have a lot of mango trees. So we usually pick some mangoes and just eat them. Yes.
And I remember also they have this animal called a carabao, which is actually like an ox. It's not a caribou, which is a reindeer, but this is a big ox in the Philippines.
Oh, yes, yes. Very helpful, like, you know, with the farmers. Because they're the one who's like cultivating all the soils before, you know, planting the rice. So I remember watching them growing up, you know, how the carabaos and everything, the farmers, you know. And, so just amazing.
And they work well in water.
Oh my God, yeah.
So they're good animal for rice, flooded rice fields.
Yes, yes.
They can
yes,
plow them and so
yes,
forth.
Yes, yes.
But they're very gentle animals, right?
Yes.
They don't like attack you or something.
Oh, they don't. They're, you know, they're very smart. And, you know, I used to like touch it and, you know, they're very calm and very friendly.
Did you ever have carabao milk?
Yes, actually. Very traditional, you know, thing in the Philippines to try the carabao milk. And we usually eat it in the morning. You warm the milk and you eat it with this fish called tuyo that you fry it. It's very salty, but when you mix it with the milk and with the warm rice, it's just perfect combination in the morning. So that's my favorite.
One of my favorite things in the Philippines also was these little bakeries. Every few blocks, there's a little, a very little store where like a family is baking fresh.
Pandesal.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the things. In the morning, you would go out to these bakeries, get pandesal. It's a roll. And they would be hot right out of the oven.
Yes.
You get a bag
yes,
of these.
Very traditional.
Take it home.
Yes, yes. Very traditional. And you usually share them with family members. You know, like, or, you know, your neighbors. If you see them, like, in the morning, you ask them, hey, would you love some fresh pandesal? Yeah.
I think it originally came from Spain.
Mm.
But it's kind of a European roll, but it's just, I don't know, I've never had anything like that, except at a Philippine bakery. There was one in Silver Lake a while ago. I think it's gone. But where I was at, we would eat it with a thick, hot cocoa drink.
Oh, wow.
And they would take these chocolate balls.
Yes,
they would take
yes.
make it right from cocoa
wow.
pods, grind it up with sugar into these balls. And when they wanted it in the morning, you'd have a little demi-tasse of super thick chocolate. And
wow,
you would dip the
pandesal
in.
Yes, yes.
Did
yes,
you have
tableya.
That one?
It's called like tableya.
Tableya.
Yeah.
Well, in your region, what did you have the pandesal with?
You know, we usually have it with butter or like, you know, like traditionally with coffee. People love to eat it with their coffee, like warm in the morning. So you'll see people, you know, in their balcony having their coffee and eating their pandesal. So, you know, I miss that.
I sure miss that too. It was so nourishing to
yes,
be there.
And
I mean, there's a lot of problems in the Philippines.
Right, yes.
And there's
right
terrible
now.
Poverty and corruption, but there's also some great beauty and warmth and
oh,
kindness.
Yes.
And very educated peoples, actually.
Yes.
People really are, you know, you could talk to some guy out in the woods and he knows a lot. So, well, all right. From reminiscing yes. about carabao and pandesal, let's hear some of L.A. Theater Works' Babbitt by Sinclair Lewis. You know, from a time that was also very slow.
Sweet time.
Yeah, you'll hear some yes. of the actual production. I recommend all 14 hours of this one. You can find it on Canopy, like LA libraries have it. you know, for free with if you're a member. So you can have access to these wonderful plays. Here we go.
Babbitt by Sinclair Lewis. The LA Classic Theatre Works presentation of the complete novel directed by Gordon Hunt. Babbitt will be heard in 29 installments with the characters and narration performed by the following members of the LA Classic Theatre Works: Ed Asner, René Aubergenois, Bonnie Bedelia, Ed Begley Jr., Georgia Brown, Roscoe Lebron, Jack Coleman, Bud Cort, Ted Danson, William Devane, Richard Dreyfuss, Hector Elizondo, Fionnuala Flanagan, Robert Foxworth, Harry Hamlin, Julie Harris, Helen Hunt, Amy Irving, Stacey Keach, John Lithgow, Nan Martin, Marsha Mason, Richard Masser, Marion Mercer, Joanna Miles, Holly Palance, Judge Reinhold, Franklin Seals, David Selby, Ali Sheedy, Madeline Smith, James Whitmore, Jo Beth Williams, and Michael York. Ed Asner will be heard as George F. Babbitt, with Nan Martin as Myra Babbitt. Narrating in part one are Georgia Brown, Richard Dreyfuss, Robert Foxworth, Amy Irving, Marsha Mason, and Jo Beth Williams. Part one, Babbitt, by Sinclair Lewis.
The towers of Zenith aspired above the morning mist, austere towers of steel and cement and limestone, sturdy as cliffs and delicate as silver rods. They were neither citadels nor churches, but frankly and beautifully, office buildings.
The mist took pity on the fretted structures of earlier generations. The post office with its shingle-tortured mansard, the red brick minarets of hulking old houses, factories with stingy and sooted windows, wooden tenements colored like mud. The city was full of such grotesqueries, but the clean towers were thrusting them from the business centers, and on the farther hills were shining new houses, homes they seemed for laughter and tranquility.
Over a concrete bridge fled a limousine of long, sleek hood and noiseless engine. These people in evening clothes were returning from an all-night rehearsal of a little theater play, an artistic adventure considerably illuminated by champagne. Below the bridge curved a railroad, a maze of green and crimson lights. The New York Flyer boomed past, and 20 lines of polished steel leaped into the glare.
In one of the skyscrapers, the wires of the Associated Press were closing down. The telegraph operators wearily raised their celluloid eyeshades after a night of talking with Paris and Peking. Through the building crawled the scrub women, yawning, their old shoes slapping. The dawn mist spun away. Queues of men with lunchboxes clumped toward the immensity of new factories, sheets of glass and hollow tile, glittering shops where 5,000 men worked beneath one roof, pouring out the honest wares that would be sold up the Euphrates and across the veldt. The whistles rolled out in greeting, a chorus cheerful as the April dawn, the song of labor in a city built, it seemed, for giants.
There was nothing of the giant in the aspect of the man who was beginning to awaken on the sleeping porch of a Dutch colonial house in that residential district of Zenith known as Floral Heights. His name was George F. Babbitt. He was 46 years old now, in April 1920, and he made nothing in particular, neither butter nor shoes nor poetry, but he was nimble in the calling of selling houses for more than people could afford to pay. His large head was pink, his brown hair thin and dry. His face was babyish in slumber, despite his wrinkles and the red spectacle dents on the slopes of his nose. He was not fat, but he was exceedingly well-fed. His cheeks were pads, and the unroughened hand which lay helpless upon the khaki-colored blanket was slightly puffy. He seemed prosperous, extremely married, and unromantic. And altogether unromantic appeared this sleeping porch, which looked on one sizable elm, two respectable grass plots, a cement driveway, and a corrugated iron garage. Yet Babbitt was again dreaming of the fairy child, a dream more romantic than scarlet pagodas by a silver sea. For years the fairy child had come to him. Where others saw but Georgie Babbitt, she discerned gallant youth. She waited for him in the darkness beyond mysterious groves. When at last he could slip away from the crowded house, he darted to her. His wife, his clamoring friends, sought to follow, but he escaped. The girl fleet beside him, and they crouched together on a shadowy hillside. She was so slim, so white, so eager. She cried that he was gay and valiant, but she would wait for him, that they would sail...
Rumble and bang of the milk truck. Babbitt moaned, turned over, struggled back toward his dream. He could see only her face now, beyond misty waters. The furnace man slammed the basement door. A dog barked in the next yard. As Babbitt sank blissfully into a dim, warm tide, the paper carrier went by whistling, and the rolled-up advocate thumped the front door. Babbitt roused, his stomach constricted with alarm. As he relaxed, he was pierced by the familiar and irritating rattle of someone cranking a Ford. Snap-a-ah, snap-a-ah, snap-a-ah. Himself a pious motorist, Babbitt cranked with the unseen driver. With him waited through taut hours for the roar of the starting engine. With him agonized as the roar ceased. And again began the infernal, patient snap-a-ah. A round, flat sound, a shivering, cold morning sound. A sound infuriating and inescapable. Not till the rising voice of the motor told him that the Ford was moving was he released from the panting tension. He glanced once at his favorite tree, elm twigs against the gold patina of sky, and fumbled for sleep as for a drug. He, who had been a boy very credulous of life, was no longer greatly interested in the possible and improbable adventures of each new day. He escaped from reality till the alarm clock rang at 7:20.
It was the best of nationally advertised and quantitatively produced alarm clocks, with all modern attachments, including cathedral chime, intermittent alarm, and a phosphorescent dial.
Babbitt was proud of being awakened by such a rich device.
Socially, it was almost as creditable as buying expensive cord tires.
He sulkily admitted now that there was no more escape, but he lay and detested the grind of the real estate business.
And disliked his family.
And disliked himself for disliking them.
The evening before, he had played poker at Virgil Gunch's till midnight, and after such holidays, he was irritable before breakfast.
It may have been the tremendous home-brewed beer of the Prohibition era, and the cigars to which that beer enticed him.
It may have been resentment of return from this fine, bold man world to a restricted region of wives and stenographers and of suggestions not to smoke so much.
From the bedroom beside the sleeping porch, his wife's detestably cheerful,
"Time to get up, Georgie boy!"
and the itchy sound, the brisk and scratchy sound of combing hairs out of a stiff brush.
He grunted.
He dragged his thick legs in faded baby blue pajamas from under the khaki blanket.
He sat on the edge of the cot, running his fingers through his wild hair while his plump feet mechanically felt for his slippers.
He looked regretfully at the blanket, forever a suggestion to him of freedom and heroism.
He had bought it for a camping trip which had never come off.
It symbolized gorgeous loafing.
Gorgeous cursing.
Virile flannel shirts. He creaked to his feet, groaning at the waves of pain which passed behind his eyeballs.
Though he waited for their scorching recurrence, he looked blurrily out at the yard. It delighted him, as always. It was the neat yard of a successful businessman of Zenith. That is, it was perfection and made him also perfect.
He regarded the corrugated iron garage. For the 365th time in a year, he reflected,
"No class of that tin shack. I have to build me a frame garage. By golly, it's the only thing on the place that isn't up to date."
While he stared, he thought of a community garage for his acreage development, Glen Oriole.
He stopped puffing and jiggling.
His arms were akimbo.
His petulant, sleep-swollen face was set in harder lines.
He suddenly seemed capable.
An official.
A man to contrive.
To direct.
To get things done.
On the vigor of his idea, he was carried down the hard, clean, unused-looking hall into the bathroom.
Though the house was not large, it had, like all houses on Floral Heights, an altogether royal bathroom of porcelain and glazed tile and metal sleek as silver.
The towel rack was a rod of clear glass set in nickel.
The tub was long enough for a Prussian guard, and above the set bowl was a sensational exhibit of toothbrush holder,
shaving brush holder,
soap dish,
sponge dish,
and medicine cabinet, so glittering and so ingenious that they resembled an electrical instrument board.
But the Babbitt, whose god was modern appliances, was not pleased. The air of the bathroom was thick with the smell of a heathen toothpaste.
"We're on a banana again. Instead of sticking a lily doll like I've repeatedly asked her, she's gone and gotten some confounded stingum stuff that makes you sick."
The bath mat was wrinkled and the floor was wet.
His daughter Verona eccentrically took baths in the morning now and then.
He slipped on the mat and slid against the tub. He said,
"Damn!"
Furiously, he snatched up his tube of shaving cream. Furiously, he lathered with a belligerent slapping of the unctuous brush. Furiously, he raked his plump cheeks with a safety razor. It pulled. The blade was dull. He said,
"Damn! Oh, damn it!"
He hunted through the medicine cabinet for a packet of new razor blades, reflecting as invariably,
"Be cheaper to buy one of these dinguses and strop your own blades."
And when he discovered the packet, behind the round box of bicarbonate of soda, he thought ill of his wife for putting it there, and very well of himself for not saying, "Damn."
But he did say it immediately afterward, when with wet and soap-slippery fingers he tried to remove the horrible little envelope and crisp-clinging oiled paper from the new blade.
"Damn!"
Then there was the problem, oft pondered, never solved, of what to do with the old blade, which might imperil the fingers of his young.
As usual, he tossed it on top of the medicine cabinet, with a mental note that someday he must remove the 50 or 60 other blades that were also temporarily piled up there.
He finished his shaving in a growing testiness, increased by his spinning headache and by the emptiness in his stomach.
When he was done, his round face smooth and streamy and his eyes stinging from soapy water, he reached for a towel.
The family towels were wet.
Wet and clammy and vile.
All of them wet, he found, as he blindly snatched them. His own face towel.
His wife's.
Verona's.
Ted's.
Tinka's.
And the lone bath towel with the huge welt of initial. Then George F. Babbitt did a dismaying thing.
He wiped his face on the guest towel.
It was a pansy-embroidered trifle, which always hung there to indicate that the Babbitts were in the best Floral Heights society.
No one had ever used it.
No guest had ever dared to.
Guests secretly took a corner of the nearest regular towel.
He was raging.
"By golly, here they go and use up all the towels. Every doggone one of them. And they use them and get them all wet and sopping and never put out a dry one for me. Of course, I'm the goat, and then I want one, and I'm the only person in the doggone house that's got the slightest doggone bit of consideration for other people, and thoughtfulness, and consider there may be others that may want to use the doggone bathroom after me, and consider..."
He was pitching the chill abominations into the bathtub, pleased by the vindictiveness of that desolate flapping sound.
And in the midst, his wife serenely trotted in, observed serenely,
"Why, Georgie, dear, what are you doing? Are you going to wash out the towels? Why, you needn't wash out the towels. Oh, Georgie, you didn't go and use the guest towel, did you?"
It is not recorded that he was able to answer.
Well, we have to kind of wrap up this reading of Babbitt by Sinclair Lewis as produced by L.A. Theater Works, latw.org. This is really a remarkable production, actually, one of the early ones. But they have just all kinds of plays from all kinds of genres. I just got done with a bunch of Russian, let's see, Dostoevsky and Chekhov. And anyway, Christine,
yes.
We are in the closing moments, and then we are going to make room for Pat with Alien Air. What would you like to tell Los Angeles as a final comment?
Final comment, I would love to say that life is very magical. And it was a lovely, wonderful night to be here with you, Pete.
Well, I think people could get a feeling about the peace and flow and grace around you, Christine. And I hope to be making more radio with you and exposing my audience,
yes,
to your wonderful, kind heart, you know, they feel you.
Ah, I'm so grateful. Sharing love and magic to the universe. Yay.
So people can reach me at mysticpete.com and mysticpete on social media. I'm on Saturday nights and Tuesday nights at late in the evening with my show called In a Dream with Mystic Pete, which features the DJ community. Where can people reach you?
They can reach me at Le Petit Spa.
You do healing.
Yay. I love healing.
All righty. Well, thank you so much for listening. And we will be back next week with the very best of,
yes,
talk radio. Mystic Pete out.
Yay.